Even though I learned about flying from that, has focused almost exclusively on flying in the U.S., there are listeners all over the world, and flying regulations in every country are different. For example, a British student pilot doesn't have to meet night flying requirements to earn a private ticket. But what happens when that same pilot earns an instrument rating in the U.S. and then wants to fly VFR at night? It's a regulations versus skills scenario that could lead to disaster. On this episode of I Laughed, I learned about flying from that. Hello and welcome to episode 76 of I Learned About Flying From That. I'm your host, Rob Ryder, and if you're new to the podcast, it's based on Flying Magazine's most widely read column in their nearly 100 years of publication. On today's program, British instrument-rated pilot Andrew Levison recounts two stories, one in the UK and the other in the US. Both stories, though, involve skills that are important to have no matter where or when you fly. We'll chat with Andrew right after this message from our sponsor, the Avemco Aviation Insurance Company. Ask your flight school or FBO if their insurance covers you when you rent their plane. The answer is almost certainly no. Even if they do, you'll probably still be on the hook for a big deductible. But for as low as $95 a year, an Avemco Insurance Company renter's policy will protect you with no deductible ever. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 and you'll be covered the next time you fly. Now, I learned about flying from that. Andrew Levison is my guest on I Laugh today, and Andrew is over in the UK. It's early in the morning here in the United States at the time of this recording, and midday for you, just after lunchtime. Andrew, welcome to I Learned About Flying From That.
Thanks, Robin. It's actually a pleasure to join you, and it's a real privilege to be able to share my story with you.
You've got two of them, and both are very interesting in terms of what you probably learned about flying from that, neither of which was... Well, one of them could have been deadly. The other, you had some help, but we'll get to that in a minute. You were telling me before we pressed the go button that you got your interest in flying because your parents used to fly you around a lot. You did a lot of travel when you were a kid.
I did. I mean, in those days, in the sort of 60s and 70s, flying abroad was relatively unusual, certainly in Europe. I think it probably was in the US as well. My parents were always keen travelers, and we often used to do these charter flights mainly around Europe, although we did go to the US in the mid-70s. But I guess it sparked my interest in flying because we spent a lot of time flying on these early generation jets like the Comet and the Vickers Viscount.
Wait a minute. I got to stop you. You actually flew on the de Havilland Comet? What a treat that must have been.
Yeah, it certainly. I mean, I don't have strong memories of it because I was clearly quite young at the time, but I know that I flew on these very early generation aircraft, and I have an interest in that sort of a history of aviation, so I appreciate it probably more than most. But it certainly was something that generated my interest in flying, got me into aviation life, because I haven't got any flying background at all in my family. None of my previous, my early family have actually flown before, so I was the first one to fly.
Very cool. And you got your license in the United Kingdom.
I did. I got into an airfield called Leavesden, which sadly closed a number of years ago now, but it used to be the over Rolls-Royce, strangely. They used to build engines there, helicopter engines there. So I learned there, and it's actually now the Harry Potter Studios, strangely. That's what it's become ever since. But I learned there, and it was a fantastic place to fly. So I learned there, and I never actually flew much after that, but I started flying in other airfields around London after that, after I got my license.
Flying in the UK is different from the US because you've done both. You wound up over here and did a lot of flying as well. Tell me about, if you will, just a little bit about the difference between flying in the United Kingdom and flying in the United States in terms of the cost of it. And I am told that there is some move afoot to charge you every time you contact air traffic control. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I don't think that's entirely true, but certainly it's a different game flying in the UK. It's certainly a lot more regulated, and around London there's a lot more airspace to be concerned about. And controlled airspace in the UK is generally only reserved for commercial instrument traffic. So general aviation generally can't go into that unless they have an instrument rating. So you're quite restricted to where you can fly. Most airfields close at sunset, so you can't generally land at most airfields after dark. And also, it's a lot more expensive generally. So overall, there's a lot fewer general aviation pilots in the UK compared to the US. And the US, for many general aviation pilots in this country, certainly was a magnet for flying, places like Florida, California, which with the great weather, the relatively cheap flying, and the large number of airports, which were open 24/7, provided a huge attraction for a lot of UK pilots. So I've always enjoyed flying in the US because I spent 2 years working there. I had a chance to spend 2 years flying, and I did a lot of hours in that 2 years I was spent in the US. And even now, if I was given the opportunity, I would probably choose to fly in the US compared to the UK because I've always enjoyed flying over there.
There are those here in the United States who think things are restrictive, but it's child's play compared to Great Britain.
It certainly is. I mean, certainly when you land anywhere, virtually every airport has a landing fee with a very few exceptions. As I say, there's a lot of airspace you're not allowed to go into. And there's certainly a lot of regulated airspace around London. So it actually, you have to plan your journeys very carefully. We don't have the free airspace that you might do in the US. But I make the most of it. I mean, flying is flying, right? So, I enjoy it, but it's certainly doesn't have the freedom that you enjoy in the US.
I hear that. Well, hopefully we will not wind up being charged per operation here in the United States. I have some friends who are very concerned about it, who have flown recently in the UK, and they do not want that to happen here in the United States with those kinds of restrictions that some people think are already more restrictive than they need to be. But that's a story not for I Learned About Flying From That. Let's talk about your first I Laughed story, Andrew.
Yeah.
And it is one in which you were IFR. So tell me when it happened, what kind of airplane you were flying, were you instrument rated, and tell me about what happened when things didn't go quite right.
Yeah, so I got my American instrument rating in Florida in 1992, because a lot of people give the American instrument rating because it's a far more straightforward rating to get compared to the UK one. So I had my instrument rating, which I was using back in the UK. And I've had a Piper Arrow, Shiona Piper Arrow, for the last 20-odd years or so. And I was doing quite a lot of instrument flying about 10 to 15 years ago. And I flew up to a place called Howardham, which is up near Chester, up in the northwest of England. And I was coming back on an instrument flight plan with a very close friend of mine who I'd met when I was working in Seattle, Jai. He's called Jai Rambasan. He was an airline captain at the time for US Airways. And he was sitting right-hand seat, so clearly a very experienced aviator. And we were coming back at IFR. We were in the cloud, just descending. We were being cleared to descend down to about 5,000 feet, I think, from 9,000 feet, still in controlled airspace. And as we were coming down, Jai was sitting in the right-hand seat, and he sort of nudged me and said, "Andrew, your airspeed indicator is just going down, just going right down to about 60 knots." And I realized clearly we weren't at 60 knots because we were descending probably, I would guess, 130, 140 knots. And clearly things weren't right. He picks up straight away, and I knew straight away that things weren't right, the airspeed indicator. Unfortunately, as I noticed it, and as we were descending, I broke out of cloud. And essentially, I was very wary of it straight away. And in fact, there was no panic at the time, because I kind of knew what had happened. And Jai was with me, which was very assuring, a very experienced aviator. And in fact, when we leveled off and we went out of controlled airspace, coming back to my base airfield at Denham, and when we landed there, the airspeed indicator was actually indicating zero. So I landed with no airspeed whatsoever. Now, there had been indications in the past that things weren't quite right with this airspeed indicator, with one of the other members of our group who'd actually had problems with the airspeed with a few weeks previously, but it had come back spontaneously. It'd been on a long trip, VFR, come back, and it actually resolved spontaneously. So in many ways, I think we'd had warnings there, which probably we hadn't dealt with at the time. And in fact, it's like a lot of these things, if something happens and it just resolves spontaneously, the chances are it's going to happen again, and we should have taken this far more seriously. But all was well in the end. We landed without an airspeed indicator. I've known this aircraft for 20 plus years, and I managed quite happily to land without an airspeed indicator. But it certainly was something that was obviously a little bit worrying at the time, but having an experienced aviator sitting in the right hand seat with me made a massive difference.
When I was working on my private license and instrument ratings, my instructors told me that I needed to know power settings for different modes of flight, straight and level, 500 feet per minute climbs and descents. Did you have those numbers in your head for the aero, or did you just know because the engine was still producing power that you'd be okay? Because without knowing your airspeed, you might extend the flaps or gear at an airspeed in excess of the pilot's operating handbook V-speeds.
I think it was a combination of both, Rob. I mean, I think I knew the airplane so well, you just get a feel for it, I think. And I did know my power settings, probably not as well as I should have known, but I kind of just knew for the feel of it that what was right. And I've been into Denham so many times, it just, I could do it without the airspeed. And it didn't seem such a drama at the time, but it was a combination of both, really. I think knowing the airplane well in that situation is a massive advantage. If you've flown for a few hundred hours in it, it makes it a lot easier if you do lose your airspeed indicator. Clearly, practice for it when you do your instrument rating, but actually doing it in real is actually different. But I think I was fairly comfortable flying an airspeed indicator at that time.
What kind of temperatures, outside air temperatures, were you dealing with on that flight? I'm assuming there was no ice or you wouldn't have been there in an aero. But if it was in, say, 50 degrees Fahrenheit, did you turn on, as a matter of course, your pitot heat?
I'm pretty sure. I mean, my practice then was always turn on pitot heat, regardless of temperature, whenever I was in the cloud. And it's a while ago, and I can't remember I had it on, but I'd be pretty confident I had it on. And in fact, I realized subsequently it wasn't the problem with the pitot icing, because we had the pitot checked and was actually a blockage in the pitot system, which we then have rectified by an engineer. So I realized straight away it wasn't the pitot ice that was the problem.
Did they say, was it a bug?
I didn't actually know in the end, because they just blew compressed air through the system. So I'm not sure they actually ever identified anything, but certainly there was a blockage of some description, which was rectified very simply when they actually addressed the problem in the engineering within the next few weeks.
And no other difficulties with it since, I'm assuming?
No, I haven't. But I've been very lucky, actually. I'm certainly taking it into I'm certainly very wary of it now, and I always check it, obviously, as we always do on the roll for takeoff. But certainly, yeah, I mean, if it did happen again, I think it would be a complete disaster. It's not ideal, but I think I certainly learned a lot from that in terms of the way I fly the airplane. And I think, hopefully, as I say, I could manage without an airspeed indicator in the future if I really had to.
Just backing up a little bit, how was the aircraft equipped? Was it a standard six-pack in the airplane at that point, or did you have some electronic flight information?
No, we've
system?
Got a basic six-pack. I think we had a King GPS. We've got a 430 now, but we had a King then. So nothing fancy. It was fairly basic instrumentation. IFR legal, but it's certainly basic. So I didn't have any backup in that respect, apart from just a GPS, which I suppose, yes, you could use as sort of backup, depending on the wind, obviously. But I didn't need that. I mean, as I say, I was reasonably confident the type to fly, make the landing without an airspeed indicator.
So even without, you still had the GPS and you could get a ground speed readout from that if you needed it.
Yes, I did. That's right. I did have that. The panel mounted one was very basic, but I had a handheld one that's sitting on a mobile portable one that's sitting up on the dashboard, which I used.
I remember getting in a situation where early in the days where the yoke mounted GPS, the small portable Garmin GPS, saved my bacon on a couple of occasions. So yeah, nice to have. All right. That's the first story, landing without incident. The second one, let's bring it across the pond back to the United States. And this, we're actually backing up in time in terms of your experience as a pilot. Were you a student pilot when your second ILAF incident occurred?
No, I mean, I'd only got my license about 3 months previously in the UK, and I was with this friend of mine, David, who I work with, and we were doing some hours together in Florida. And because we just basically wanted to build some time, and Florida offered the opportunity to do relatively cheap flying. We're in relatively unrestricted airspace, so we thought we'd go over there and just do some flying around Florida. So we rented a Cessna 152, Space Center Executive was called at the time. It's now called Space Coast Regional in Titusville. Okay. And we just were basically flying around various destinations in Florida. And my incident happened on one of those trips, essentially, in the 152. And we would take it, David and me would take it in turns to fly pilot command. And I was the pilot command on this particular flight.
How long was the flight going to be from Space Coast to where you were headed then?
So it was actually Sarasota to Space Center executive. And essentially, what happened is we landed in Sarasota for a relatively uneventful flight. I think it was from Naples. And we realized that we got a flat nose wheel, which obviously wasn't ideal. So we weren't quite sure what to do. But fortunately, there was one of the instructors from where we were flying from at Space Center executive. And he was there, and he kind of sorted out to get the nose wheel changed. Clearly, that can't happen quickly, and it took probably a good hour to get the nose wheel changed. And by this stage, it was getting kind of late in the afternoon. And we weren't expecting, obviously, to be in Sarasota for that period of time. So by the time the nose wheel was fixed, it was going to be potentially dark by the time we got back to Space Center Executive. And I kind of realized this, really, but I kind of was not keen to get stuck in Sarasota with an hour and nearly 2 hour flight back to Space Center. And I kind of made the decision that we should just go and just, I kind of probably didn't take account of the fact it was going to get dark. My friend David had actually got a night rate at the time, but I'd done no night flying whatsoever. So I'd done absolutely none. Because I was a rookie pilot, I'd maybe got 65 hours under my belt by that stage. So it's very early on in my flying career. And we decided to depart from Sarasota back to Titusville, knowing it was going to get dark by the time we got back.
So the only flying at night that you ever experienced was with an instructor when you were working on your private pilot's license.
No, we didn't. In those days, in the UK, we don't do night flying as part of our PPL. It's done after you qualify. So I've done no night flying whatsoever.
Oh, my. Yeah. This is something that you have known. Then the world got very gorgeous at night, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was lovely, but I didn't really appreciate really what I was doing in many ways. David had a bit more of a clue than me because, he got a night rating, probably only a handful of hours under his belt. He was a little bit more experienced than me, but not a huge amount. So yeah, it was good experience at the time, but I suppose I really wasn't prepared for it. That I should have been. It was a bad decision to get back to Space Coast or Space
we'll
Center
talk
at
about
night.
That. At night, how did you navigate at that point? I'm assuming that a Cessna 152 did not have dual navcoms or anything like that. You probably had one navcom and you could tune in a VOR and fly toward it, at least know what radial you were on. And if necessary, tune to another frequency and cross-reference and triangulate your position. How did you know where you were when you were flying back?
Absolutely right, Rob. That's all we had. I think my recollection is one VOR to get back. So it was basic instrumentation, but I think we'd been flying around Florida for two or three days by then. We had a little bit of orientation how to get back to Space Center, but very limited. But we managed to get back, and it's well lit up and whatever. But certainly there was no benefit of GPS in those days. So it was basic, really basic navigation.
Without being able to do pilotage, you were stuck with dead reckoning and one VOR, but you got disoriented, didn't you?
I did. So when we got back to Space Center, we were given, to be honest, I can't remember what direction it was in the circuit, but I was given a circuit join there. And essentially, I was disorientated, completely disorientated. And when I joined the circuit, I joined the wrong direction. Or the pattern. Sorry, I meant to use the American term pattern. But I joined the wrong direction.
We've got that.
You must excuse me if I'm using English terms. I should be familiar with
not
American terms
at
as well,
all. Just we've got it. We can deal with it. It's not a problem at all.
But no, I joined in the wrong direction. And I really didn't know what I was doing joining in the pattern. And essentially what then happened is I saw an aircraft coming directly towards me. And to this day, I can remember that red and green lights coming directly towards me. And my God, I tell you, it still sticks in my mind even to this day. But the immediate response was to make the standard right-hand turn if someone's coming directly towards you. And it turned out subsequently it was a Seneca. And this Seneca also made a right turn. So we did the right thing at the time. And fortunately, that was the end of it. And I managed to join the pattern in the right direction and land. And all was well. No one was hurt. But to this day, I realize how significant that incident was, and it could have been a much worse outcome. And when I walked in the FBO afterwards, I met the instructor, the Seneca, and I was amazed. He was remarkably calm. I mean, I could have killed that man, and he was remarkably calm about it. And I suppose I didn't probably appreciate the significance of that because I was, as I say, I was relatively inexperienced. But now it really, as I say, to this day, it haunts me in a way. That I made such a major error that could have a much worse outcome.
Were there radio communications that you heard from the Seneca as you approached the airport? Because at that point, that's a non-towered field, correct?
Yeah. Yes, I think he was tired during the day, if I remember correctly, and tired at night. That was my recollection. No, is the answer to your question. I cannot recall that. But again, because of my inexperience, it probably wouldn't have had the same significance if I'd been a much more experienced pilot. I think it was a lack of experience that was a key factor here.
You could see the runway, you could see the lights, and you assumed you were on the downwind for the runway you wanted, on which you wanted to land.
Absolutely. But it was, you know, I didn't appreciate a direction. I think you're right, because untowered, I was presumably listening to the traffic, letting out, but I completely misinterpreted whatever direction they were using. And it was an extremely bad error. As I say, it haunts me to this day.
When you landed, did you have the shakes at that point and dry mouth and the sweats?
You bet I did. You bet. I certainly did. I mean, it was one of the scariest moments, I think, in my whole sort of, I've been flying for 30 plus years now. It's just one of the scariest moments I've ever had. And I've never had anything quite as bad since then.
You've also graduated to a lot more complex airplanes. You got a multi, you've flown Barons and other aircraft, multi-engine aircraft as well. So you've built up a lot of experience. That's not a mistake you're ever going to make again, is it?
I sincerely hope not. I mean, yes, I did most of my complex flying, my training in the US, because I did my multi in Seattle. I did my commercial single multi-engine in Seattle. But nowadays, I just fly an aero. But I've got over 1,000 hours of time now, so I hope the experience would prevent me doing that. And in fact, I'm now doing a sort of instructor's type rating. That's a new challenge for me. I'm doing a sort of instructor's type rating over here, which will hopefully make my flying better. Because I think after 30 years of flying, I'd like to give something back. So I'm going to do. It's not a full instructor's rating. It's called what's called a CRI, which is a class rating instructors, which gives you some privileges to do bio flight reviews. And also do complex sign-offs, etc. But you can't teach ab initio pilots. But I think I'm hopefully able to get something back, and I'm quite looking forward to the challenge doing this rating.
That is very, very laudable, Andrew. Let's take a break, and we're going to back up to both of these stories and find out what you learned about flying from that right after this. Avemco insured their first plane in 1961. Ironically, that same Cessna 172 became Avemco's first claim. That's what started them on a mission to improve pilot safety. They even reward safe pilots with reduced premiums. You'll save 5% for caring enough about safety to be an I Learned About Flying from That listener. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 and ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can save with the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Now, back to I Learned About Flying from That. We are back with Dr. Andrew Levinson, anesthesiologist from the UK who has stories from both the UK and the United States in his flying. Andrew, let's go to the first story about the airspeed indicator. What did you learn about flying from that?
Well, I think first thing, Rob, is there were some warnings about this block PTO system. One of the other members of the group who flies the Arrow had a problem with their airspeed and had a couple of times flying previously, and we didn't get it rectified. We should have got it rectified. So those are warning signs. And I think if ever you have something like that, get it looked at. Don't just ignore it. Even if it just resolves on its own, it's probably going to happen again. And it happened, not the worst possible time, but it happened the rather inconvenient time when I was actually IFR. But fortunately, it was a good result at the end because no one was hurt. And the other thing is knowing your airplane well. I think if you lose the airspeed indicator, if you know the airplane well, you know the speeds, you know the settings, then you can land it without an airspeed indicator. And I think next time you fly, just practice it. Maybe put a cover over it. Maybe just have a look at the power settings when you're coming in to land and just see if you can manage it without the airspeed indicator. So if you do lose it, then it's not a panic. Like a lot of these emergencies, if you practice, then when it happens for real, then it won't happen again. Then it will hopefully won't be a panic if it happens for real.
Over and over again, I assume.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Practice. You go just practice. And I probably don't practice it like I should do. I don't practice it enough, and I probably should do. I'm probably as guilty as most of not practicing.
I think that's true for many of us. And I have learned from this podcast that I should be always looking more carefully at my out in case of an engine failure, irrespective of where I am. So
yeah.
That's that's become part of my scan. So good lessons learned. I'm glad it wasn't it was just a matter of blowing some air through it, and whatever it was that was doing the partial blockage cleared up, and no problem since.
Yeah, absolutely. So touch wood, we've had no problems since whatsoever. But I'm wary of it. I think about it now. You know, it's something I've had it once, and I'm worried that it might happen again. It happened to anyone. And you just want to be, you want to be ready for it if it happens.
The second situation involved a judgment issue for you, because you knew that night was approaching, but you fell victim to what so many of us do, and that's get-home-itis. What did you learn about flying from that after almost colliding with a Seneca going opposite directions on downwind?
I mean, I think, as we know, most accidents occur before you've been taken off by bad decision-making. Most general aviation accidents, or indeed commercial, are just bad decision-making. And this was a classic example. And I think I try to be as careful as possible in my decision-making before I fly. I'm as thorough as possible. And this was exacerbated by the fact I was very inexperienced and I made a bad decision. But there was a bit of confirmation bias there that I kind of ignored the fact in many ways it was going to get dark. And I just thought I carried on and just keep your fingers crossed, hope for the best. And I was probably also lulled into full sense of security. The fact my friend David, had a bit of night experience. I thought, well, you know, we can sort of fudge through this one if we have to, coming back at night. And despite the fact I was not legal, because I wasn't night rated, and it was a bad decision. And I think what I've learned is I should be very careful in the decision making before you fly. As I say, most accidents occur before you've even taken off. So that was a big lesson for me, Rob.
That's a good one. And get-home-itis has caused problems for so many. And I can tell you that when my wife and I were once coming back from Maine, we ended up having to spend two nights in Schenectady, New York, because weather was not going to allow us to get through. We had to shoot an ILS into Schenectady, and we were sat on the ground for 2 days before the weather cleared up. So get-home-itis, boy, we had it, but there was nothing we could do about it. But I'm so glad that your get-home-itis ended up being a non-issue for you. And when you said that the gentleman who was flying the Seneca was very calm about it, you had to be grateful that he did not climb all over you like you were some idiot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is 30 years ago, and I think it was nowadays, we'd definitely be filing reports. And certainly there would be a lot of repercussions to something like this. And then it didn't seem like I'd really had to. I mean, I didn't really know the FAA rules particularly, but I probably should have filed a report. But nowadays, I definitely would have to. Certainly if it happened in this country, there'd definitely been a report, an investigation by the CAA, who are a regulatory authority. So there's no question about that. But, you know, in those days, it didn't happen, and probably I should have done. And the guy, the fact he was so calm to this day I still find remarkable, because as I say, I nearly killed the guy. And it was something that I learned hugely from, and I hopefully I'm a better pilot because of it.
Hopefully we'll all be better pilots from the lessons learned from you, Andrew Levison. Thanks so much for being on I Laughed.
Hey, Rob, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I am glad Andrew reached out to me with his stories. And I'm grateful for all of you listeners and subscribers, no matter where you are on the planet. Do you have an I Laughed story that you'd like to tell? I'd like very much to hear it. Send me an email with a synopsis of your story, and we'll consider it for an episode. My address is rob@flying.media. That's rob@flying.media. I Learned About Flying From That is available wherever you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks, so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed, and Julie Boatman is editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.